मतिना तरसाओ घर रे नार ने पियू जी मतिना तरसाओ घर रे नार ने नार ने नार ने नार ने ओ मैं तो घूमर घाला
This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hollywood film producer Harvey Weinstein has had one of his rape convictions overturned. Judges at New York's top court said Weinstein, who will remain in prison on separate sex offences, did not receive a fair trial in 2020. More details now from our correspondent Emma Vardy.
The Court of Appeals said prosecutors had called witnesses whose accusations were not part of the charges against him. That meant, it said, he was unfairly tried for past behaviour. Harvey Weinstein was also convicted in a separate rape case in LA. Last year, he was sentenced to 16 years for raping a woman in a Beverly Hills hotel. He will remain in prison while a decision is made in New York over whether to retry him. Harvey Weinstein's accusers have called the decision a major step back in holding those accountable for acts of sexual violence.
The US Supreme Court is hearing arguments on whether Donald Trump is immune from prosecution for actions he took while president. The outcome will determine whether he should face trial on charges that he plotted to overturn his 2020 election defeat. Mr. Trump says he can't be indicted under the US Constitution, but Justice Elena Kagan questioned Mr. Trump's argument.
Framers did not put an immunity clause into the Constitution. They knew how to. There were immunity clauses in some state constitutions. They knew how to give legislative immunity. They didn't provide immunity to the president. And, you know, not so surprising, they were reacting against a monarch who claimed to be above the law. Wasn't the whole point that the president was not a monarch and the president was not supposed to be above the law?
A decision isn't expected until June. Haiti's Prime Minister Ariel Henry has resigned and a transitional council has begun running the country. The body is tasked with organising elections and restoring order to Haiti, which is suffering from a wave of deadly gang violence. They now control most of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Thursday's swearing-in ceremony for the transitional council had to be moved because of continued gunfire near the National Palace. In a speech during the ceremony, the interim Prime Minister, Michel-Patrick Boisvert, said it was an important moment.
Haiti, our country, is at a crossroads in the search for solutions to overcome this multidimensional political crisis, the consequences of which are detrimental to the population, to property, and both public and private infrastructure.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has warned that the European Union faces immense risks over the coming decade at a time of upheavals around the world. He said modern Europe was mortal and could die, urging it to ensure its own security. Mr. Macron said it needed to lose what he called its naivety on defence and trade. World news from the BBC. The Prime Minister of Tanzania, Kassim Majaliwa, has said more than 150 people have died as a result of the torrential rains in East Africa, which have caused severe flooding and landslides. Mr. Majaliwa said more than 200,000 people had been affected. The region has been hit by heavier than usual rainfall, exacerbated by the El Niño weather pattern. In Nigeria, more than 100 prisoners have escaped from a jail after heavy rain damaged some of the buildings. The authorities say the inmates escaped from Suleja prison near the capital Abuja, although 10 have been recaptured. A heavy downpour on Wednesday lasted several hours and wrecked parts of the medium security jail, including the perimeter wall. The World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, has ordered an independent review into its handling of a doping case against Chinese swimmers. Here's our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
Last week, WADA and the Chinese anti-doping authorities confirmed a story dating back to 2021 that was unveiled in investigative reports, admitting that 23 of China's top swimmers were secretly allowed to continue competing after testing positive for a performance-enhancing drug. WADA says at the time it accepted Beijing's explanation that the swimmers had unwittingly ingested the drug at a swim meet. Several of the swimmers won medals at the Tokyo Olympics that year, including golds.
The authorities in Namibia have condemned tourists who posed naked at one of the country's top attractions, the Big Daddy Dune in the Namib Desert. Photos and videos of the men have been shared widely online. Other visitors told a local newspaper they were shocked by the behaviour. The tourism ministry says the unnamed foreigners are likely to be blacklisted from entering all of Namibia's parks. And that's the latest BBC News.
Literacy Network invites you to help them celebrate 50 years and toast to the next half century and free adult literacy education. From 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th at Boardman Clark, you can enjoy signature cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, and a program that features speeches from Lupita Montoto of La Movida and other supporters. All proceeds benefit Literacy Network students working toward their dreams and goals, including becoming U.S. citizens, securing job opportunities, and more. Registration information for this event is available at literacynetwork.org/50thcelebration. Deadline to register is Sunday, April 21st. In addition to the event, you can also check out the silent auction, which is live now through April 25th. That's a toast to 50 years of Literacy Network at Boardman Clark, 1 South Pinckney, from 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th. You are listening to WORT Madison.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from...
And good afternoon and welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. 100 years ago, Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Robert M. Fighting Bob La Follette made his mark on national politics by running as an independent third party for president, candidate for president. What was the significance of that 1924 campaign? What lessons might we draw from it? Joining us in the WORT studio is Richard Drake, professor of politics and history at the University of Montana and author of The Education of an Anti-Imperialist, Robert La Follette and U.S. Expansion. Professor Drake is in Madison to participate in a series of events running today through Saturday that will commemorate La Follette's 1924 presidential bid and its significance. Welcome, Richard Drake. How are you?
Very well, and thank you very much for the invitation, Alan.
Well, it's my pleasure. Let's start, Richard Drake, by your giving our listeners some broad sketch of that iconic figure of Wisconsin progressivism. Who was Bob La Follette?
Robert La Follette was one of the greatest statesmen ever produced by America. He really made his most lasting mark in American history by rebutting the war message of Woodrow Wilson, April 2nd, 1917, bringing the United States into the Great War. His speech has been described as the greatest ever given in Washington, D.C. by an American leader, and I think that's an accurate assessment of his importance. One other thing about him I think deserves mention besides his prophetic analysis of what was wrong with American imperialism and American militarism as those problems became conspicuous in the World War I era, he drew attention to the problems of the growing wealth gap in America, the growing problem of job insecurity in America. He thought that lobbies control the American political system, lobbies representing the economic interests of the power elite in America. All those criticisms, I think, were prophetic and their accuracy, their importance, reach down to our own time. So I think that's a general assessment of why he's such an important figure historically and today.
I'm wondering if you could create some broader context. That is, what prodded Robert La Follette to run for president as an independent?
Well, he ran as an independent progressive. He thought that it was important not to run the risk of labeling his campaign a progressive party campaign. He feared that that would be result in the defeat of a lot of down ballot progressives. So he wanted to wait before running as a progressive party candidate. He insisted on making it a progressive independent candidacy. But he ran because he thought the two dominant contenders, Calvin Coolidge, the incumbent president, and John W. Davis, the Democratic nominee, a Wall Street lawyer, really represented the economic status quo. And there would be no debate with those two candidates. They echoed each other, essentially. And he wanted to present a fresh voice, a voice that would be critical of the status quo, because it deserved criticism. And frankly, in his view, replacement. I think that's why he decided to throw his hat in the ring and run that storied 1924 campaign.
La Follette reasoned that the two-party system in the U.S. had failed. How so?
It failed primarily because of the lobbies. The lobbies controlled the system, the two-party system. They completely dominated the Democrats and the Republicans. There was no measurable difference between them. And he thought that that something had to be shaken up if the country were to be prevented from being taken off a cliff, which is where he thought the two parties were taking the country. We really needed a revolution in America, a revolution that would actually take the country back to its best values, the values of the American Enlightenment and the founding fathers. He was not a Marxist, he was not a socialist, but he did believe in the American Enlightenment value system that's probably his best enshrined, from his viewpoint, in the farewell address of George Washington, 1796, in which the outgoing president said, look, what we need in this country is to concentrate on developing our republic, not getting involved in foreign wars, not getting involved in entangling alliances, not developing special relationships with anybody, friendship with all, enmity toward none, not demonizing countries, not lauding them to the point of surreality. La Follette wanted to take us back to that mindset, which he thought we'd lost sight of. And his campaign was really, I think, designed to achieve that goal.
You've talked a bit about the political environment of the early 20s. Talk some about the social terrain that informed La Follette's assessment.
The social terrain following the First World War was an extremely tormented one from his viewpoint. First of all, following the war, America underwent a sharp economic downturn, period of very severe doldrums befell the country in the immediate aftermath of the war. Ironically, there was an economic upturn in 1924, the year of the campaign, which really saved Calvin Coolidge and really made his overwhelming victory possible. There's a very interesting book by Kenneth Campbell McKay called The Progressive Campaign of 1924. He goes into penetrating detail about the social terrain and the economic framework that conditioned that terrain. La Follette thought that that we really had already entered into a period of a war economy. The military budget was going up constantly in those years. He thought this was an alarming trend that would eventually eat into the producing economy, really in some fascinating ways, foreshadowing the insights of writers like Seymour Melman, who would write The Perpetual War Economy, 1985. Chalmers Johnson, another one who descends from La Follette in this interesting way. The Blowback Trilogy. All those writers have pointed to the dangers of the military-industrial complex. La Follette in 1924, when asked, what would you do fighting Bob were you to win? He said, well, the first thing I would do is cut the military budget. That is the greatest threat we have. Our threat does not lie outside the borders of the United States. Our threat comes from within. It comes from within the power elites that control the economy, control the political system, and are pushing us in a direction that bears a frightening resemblance to the direction that the Roman Republic, the ancient Roman Republic, took into becoming an empire and eventually bringing the people of Rome to defeat, destruction, and disappearance. So those were all the thoughts, I think, that Fighting Bob had in his head about the social terrain. It was a period of history that alarmed him, and he thought, even though he was 69 years old in failing health, lacking energy, he wasn't able to campaign very vigorously. He just thought he had to go out there and leave everything on the field because the fate of the country was hanging in the balance. I think he was right.
You're listening to Richard Drake, professor of politics and history at the University of Montana, author of The Education of an Anti-Imperialist, Robert La Follette and U.S. Expansion. Professor Drake is in Madison to participate in a series of events running today through Saturday that will commemorates the La Follette's 1924 presidential bid and its significance. Robert La Follette chose the reform-minded Democrat to run with him, Senator Burton K. Wheeler of Montana. Tell us about Wheeler.
Wheeler's a fascinating figure. He was about 20 years younger, actually more than that, a good deal younger than La Follette. He was born in Massachusetts into a working-class family, never went to college, but in those days you didn't need to go to college to go to law school. And he graduated from the University of Michigan Law School and ended up in Montana looking for work. He found work there, got into politics, was a labor Democrat, opposed to the Anaconda Company, the copper company that completely dominated the Montana economy. He was an adversary of that company and eventually became attorney general. He was in office when World War I broke out. He was appalled at the war hysteria that gripped Montana. He and Robert La Follette were allies, or at least shoulder to shoulder with each other on the great foreign policy issues of the day, even before Burton K. Wheeler made it to Washington as a senator. I think he came in 1922. If I'm not mistaken. But the minute they engaged in conversation with each other, they knew that they were shoulder to shoulder as political allies and close friends. And so when La Follette was looking for a vice presidential running mate, immediately thought of Wheeler as an ideal spokesman. Wheeler had the reputation in Montana for being very left-wing. His nickname there was Bolshevik Burt. Everybody thought he was some kind of a raving Marxist, which he was not. But he was very progressive left. and a very effective campaigner. He really shouldered much of the burden of the campaign because La Follette was in such poor health through that last period of his life. Remarkable figure who went on following that campaign. He went back to the Democratic Party and was a major figure in national politics, primarily as an opponent of FDR in the 1930s in the run-up to the Second World War. That's really where he achieved his greatest originality as a major figure opposing America's involvement in World War II. That's another story that we probably don't want to get into today. But in the 1920s, he was a powerful voice against the corruption in the Warren Harding administration. Teapot Dome, he played a crucial role in exposing the rot of the Teapot Dome scandal. And 1923 is the year he went to visit Europe to see what the impact of World War I was there. The same year, Fighting Bob went on a European trip. And both of those men came back and said, we don't want the United States to become involved in these ghastly wars. They were looking at the horrors, the wounded soldiers, the terrible malaise that descended on Europe after that war. War is the enemy. War is what we must avoid as defenders of civilization. And they were very much alike in their thinking about foreign policy and domestic policy, great deep friends and prophetic voices we should be listening to again in the pages of history today.
Richard Drake, you mentioned the Teapot Dome scandal. What was that? Refresh my memory, and I'm sure our listeners, it's been years since I've even it's even come to mind, but tell us about the Teapot Dome scandal a little bit.
Teapot Dome scandal for La Follette and for Wheeler was Exhibit A in the indictment of the United States political system as a conduit for corrupt economic interests. It involved transferring oil deposits in federal charge to these corrupt oil interests, the Sinclair interest most of all. And they both thought that this was the classic example of how much looting was going on in America, in peace and in war. But the American people needed to be made aware of just how corrupt their system was. And Teapot Dome was the example they kept harping on all through the 1924 campaign. They thought it was such an outrageous, such an egregious example of corruption that by itself it would lead to a groundswell of support for this 1924 independent progressive candidacy that they were both leading. Unfortunately, as I said earlier, it was in 1924 when the economic, sort of jazz age economics kicked in 1924, and the American voting public largely forgot about Teapot Dome as the economy began to rise into this roaring 20s phenomenon that sort of obliterated everything else.
What else defined the 24 Progressive Campaign? You note in an article that you did for the Progressive magazine just this month, appearing, that issues concerning racism and bigotry, but particularly the issue of the Ku Klux Klan, also defined the 24 Progressive Campaign.
Yeah, there's a wonderful book about this topic in the 20s. It's by an historian named Nancy MacLean. It's called Behind the Mask of Chivalry. It's a very important book about the second iteration of the Ku Klux Klan. The first iteration, of course, occurred immediately following the Civil War. It was an attempt to reimpose the shackles of slavery on the recently freed black people down there. And once that task had been accomplished, once the blacks had been reduced to subservience in the failed Reconstruction period, the Ku Klux Klan entered a period of relative quiescence. But then in the 1920s, there was a dramatic surge of Ku Klux Klan activity over two reasons. I mean, they still hated the blacks. They still were engaged in terroristic and criminal activities against black people with a lot of lynchings. Still that. But there were two additional problems that were equally frightening to the Klan. One was the huge influx of Roman Catholic immigrants, and two, the huge influx of Jewish immigrants. You've got Roman Catholics and Jews flooding into this country and with the threat, as perceived by the Klan, of overwhelming the Anglo-Saxon culture here. And so this second Klan demonized all three of these groups, still murderously in the case of the blacks, and really identifying Catholics and Jews as highly undesirable additions here, and everything must be done to suppress them. Nancy McLean does a terrific job, I think, in describing how all of those Klan activities unfolded in the 20s. But in 1924, the Klan was the second version of the Klan was an extremely powerful factor in American politics. And in fact, the Republicans and the Democrats kept quiet about the Klan, not La Follette. La Follette in 1924 attacked the Klan as a vicious criminal organization. If that organization were to triumph, all hope of America ever becoming a democratic society would vanish. And so he really conducted, for American presidential politics, a pioneering anti-Klan campaign, which I think reflects great credit on him. And it's another aspect of the 1924 campaign, I think, that deserves careful study today for what it can teach us about our current issues with race and immigration in America in the 21st century.
And of course, 1924 was also the year that the Klan had a major national mobilization in Washington, D.C., yes. Marched down Pennsylvania yes. Avenue by yes. the thousands and so on. But it's also, in part, fruition of that kind of reaction against the so-called new immigrant, the passage of the Immigrant Exclusion Act of the same year
yes.
that put quotas, barred Eastern Europeans, for instance, from coming in.
Right.
I also have to add that the Klan also was viciously anti-Latino, that is Chicano, Mexicano mm-hmm. in the Southwest, depending on the region,
yes.
Had different emphasis in their politics.
I think you're right about that.
You're listening to Richard Drake, historian. We're talking about Robert M. La Follette, Burton K. Wheeler, and that historic presidential campaign of 1924. If you want to join with the conversation with a comment, a question, give us a call at 608-256-2001. Well, you know, while we're still on the Klan, I've long been fascinated. Historians that talk about it as a prototypical forerunner of a kind of fascist formation mm-hmm. That it predates. Well, it parallels, of course, the rise of fascism in Italy and predates, really, the German variant, but reaction to the Max.
I think that it's interesting that one of the leading figures in contemporary Klan culture is David Duke, a very influential figure in Louisiana politics and nationally, and looking into how his ideas were formed, I read that he was deeply influenced by the American Nazi Party as a young man. So these links between the Klan racism and later developments in the fascist and Nazi movements really play out in American politics as well, only at the margins up till now. But what we're seeing, I think, in contemporary American politics with the growing extremism, the importance of extremism in American politics, these ideas are becoming more and more center stage. It's fascinating to see how Richard Hofstadter's famous book, which I'm sure you read in graduate school as I did, Alan, The American Political Tradition, Hofstadter, the leader of the consensus school of American historians, said, well, we really haven't had extremism in America. We have a centrist, sort of a moderate left liberal tradition in the Democratic Party, and a moderate right tradition in the Republican Party. And there's been no American Hitler. There's been no American Stalin or Lenin or Mao. Nothing. We haven't had that here. And to our great good fortune, we've had these centrist political traditions unfolding. Well, that could all be changing now. And it's interesting, as we talk about contemporary politics, that Trumpism, which contains some powerful anti-immigrant elements, and that I think appeals to certain white grievances, is an international phenomenon. He's popular and important not only here, but also in Europe, where for many of these right-wing populist movements and right-wing populist governments, he's a god. I follow Italian politics pretty closely. I actually was trained as a Europeanist at UCLA and spent the first part of my career, the first four books that I wrote dealt with modern Italy. And so I followed the Italian scene very closely, even though for the last 10 or 15 years, I really added American foreign policy as my main research interest. My last two books, one on La Follette and then the other one on Charles Austin Beard. I'm working on a book now on William Appleman Williams, sort of a trilogy of books that I have in mind about American foreign policy, but I'm still very close, a close observer of the Italian scene. And in one of the recent election campaigns in Italy, the leader of the Lega Party, a man named Matteo Salvini, the Lega Party is the anti-immigrant party in Italy, but it fascinated me to discover that for his campaign slogan, he was using in English, didn't even bother to translate this for the Italian audience, in English, "Go Donald." That was his mantra. And I think that reflects this international dimension of Trump's appeal and how closely tied in that is, especially in Europe, you know, with the great fear of the non-white immigration coming into Europe. That's the great driving issue in Europe of these right-wing populist party, and why they look to Trump as a kind of avatar. He's the exemplar for them. And this is why these contemporary developments really call to mind some of the points that La Follette very prophetically was talking about 100 years ago.
That mantra of build the wall.
Build the wall.
The Jade tells me that we do have a caller that's interested in coming on here. Hello, Ron. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you, Alan, for the show. Just a couple of comments. I'm Burton Wheeler. I understand from reading Albert Kahn's book, High Treason, that he was involved with the America First Committee and got hooked up with Viereck and some Nazi sympathizers at the end of the 30s. I think Wheeler's had a very checkered past, and La Follette, of course, avoided those kinds of entanglements. But Wheeler was a different character altogether and had a very, very sharp decline according to his activities with the America First Committee. And I'd like your speaker to address that issue. Thank you.
Yeah, I would address the issue, first of all, by pointing out that in the 1920s, as the caller acknowledged, Wheeler was engaged in, so far as I know, none of that kind of concern about the concerns that you raised. But I'm thinking of Wayne Cole's book on the America First Committee. Two points I'd like to make about Wayne Cole's comments about America First. The first comment involves his claim, which he claims to have documented information about, that America First was a very eclectic organization, really seeking Jewish support. And there were many Jewish members of America First. That would be the first point. And the second point regarding Wheeler personally, I mean, he was under attack in the 30s by many different groups, including groups charging America First with being an anti-Semitic organization. He said, in his own defense, he said, look, you can say what you want about America First, and I don't know every single thing about it. I do agree with its claim that we should strive to avoid the Second World War. The Second World War will be hideous. It will be the most destructive war in history. In fact, 50 million people would be killed in that war. And we should do everything we possibly can to avoid getting involved in it, to try to prevent it in every way we can. That was Wheeler's conviction. I don't think that was an insane conviction to have in the 1930s. But the main point he wanted to get out into the public, that he wanted people to know, he said, look, you can accuse America First in any way you want, but you can't accuse me of being an anti-Semite. My two top aides, the two people I trust the most in my office, are both Jewish. I don't think anti-Semites hire Jews to be their top aides. And so you have to be careful with these charges. I think your speaking to his critics in the 1930s, I think your charges are reckless. I think they're unfounded insofar as they pertain to me. And I think his defense merits close attention, and the research that Wayne Cole did in his book on America First also should be remembered. It's sort of a counterpoint to the conventional wisdom about America First as nothing but an anti-Semitic organization, which I think is an exaggeration.
You know, Fighting Bob La Follette thought that the greatest danger to democracy came not from external enemies, but from within. But on his foreign policy issues, that figured prominently in the progressive campaign. Talk about some of those foreign policy issues. You touched on some, of course, the reluctance of European entanglement and heading toward war and militarism. But there was this focus in the period, of course, on Latin America and U.S. involvement, the rest of the hemisphere.
Fighting Bob thought that our record in Latin America was shameful. It was scandalous. It was criminal. And it was a sign of what the United States was capable of in its foreign policy generally. He thought that we were exploiting these people. I mean, he really developed his mature thinking about American foreign policy as a result of his investigation of the Mexican Revolution, beginning in 1910. My book about La Follette includes a chapter on the Spanish-American War. He was a flag-waving patriot in the Spanish-American War. He thought that was a wonderful war, and the outcome was delightful. We acquired what? We acquired a practical control over Cuba. We acquired outright the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico. And he thought this was just splendid. He was a McKinley man. He was a McKinley Republican through and through. But by the time we get to 1910 and the Mexican Revolution, he's publishing in the pages of La Follette's magazine, a magazine he started in 1909. It is the predecessor of the Progressive today. He's publishing John Reed's journalism. John Reed, I mean, he would become the foremost American Marxist and was well on his way toward that radicalism as a result of what he saw in Mexico. La Follette was publishing his stuff. I've seen those articles in those early issues of La Follette's magazine. They're eye-opening. They're spectacular in their revelation about what's going on. What does John Reed say about Mexico? He said, look, the Wall Street elites, the railroad tycoons are down there exploiting the hell out of the peons. This is the American way of shouldering the white man's burden. That's what it is. La Follette, by about 1910, begins to understand what's what in American foreign policy. And from that point on, he doesn't miss much. It's interesting, this other book I've done on Charles Austin Beard. Beard was a great admirer of La Follette, especially because after they were great friends and allies in the years just before the First World War. Then with the outbreak of war, and especially with America's intervention in the war, Beard supported Wilson's policy of intervention. La Follette, of course, with equal ardor opposed it. They went off in different directions. Then after the war, especially after reading John Maynard Keynes's Economic Consequences of the Peace, this famous economist who participated in the Paris Peace Conference, wrote this scalding critique of the handiwork of the Paris Peace Conference, arguing that what the Paris Peace Conference has done January to August 1919 is to set the Second World War in motion. That's what's going to come out of this, World War II. Well, Beard, reading Keynes and reading the accounts of what the Treaty of Versailles, the Treaty of Sèvres dealing with the Middle East, two of the five treaties that came out of the Paris Peace Conference, reading those treaties, Beard said, oh my God, I was horribly wrong about this war. And La Follette was completely right about it. And he says, in effect, he said, you know, you'd think that with my Ivy League PhD in history, I would have seen some of this. I would have understood what was going on. I didn't understand anything. Whereas Bob La Follette, with his barely earned undergraduate degree from the University of Wisconsin, saw the whole thing with a fearsome lucidity. And so La Follette, by 1924, I mean, really from 1910, when he's taking in the real meaning of the Mexican Revolution as a response not only to the depredations of Mexican elites, but a response to the economic exploitation coming out of the United States, coming out of Wall Street. Once La Follette understands this, and John Reed helps him to understand this, he's on the royal road to understanding the true nature of American foreign policy and never misses a beat from that point on. So by 1924, when he rails against what we're doing in San Domingo, Nicaragua, Cuba, Haiti, all these Latin American countries, what we're doing to them what Reed saw we were doing to the Mexicans in the period of the Mexican Revolution, and what we do everywhere. This is what goes on in American foreign policy. So he's, I keep coming back to the way La Follette is a precursor of such critics of American foreign policy as Seymour Melman, that wonderful book of his, The Permanent War Economy. What that means, it means destruction of the productive economy. That's what it means. We're seeing that happening, unfolding in real time. But La Follette's a precursor of all that. And he deserves, especially his legacy from the 24 campaign, those wonderful speeches he gave, the editorials he wrote for the Progressive all through that campaign. He was trying to explain his mind, trying to convey what he was seeing in our foreign policy in Latin America. This is the way American foreign policy is going to go worldwide. If we ever have the opportunity to do to the world what we're doing to Latin America now. And I think that's another reason why he's one of the great prophets in the history of American politics.
You know, we're running short on the hour. There's so much we can discuss, Richard Drake. But let's head toward a wrap eventually. Talk about the outcome of the 24 presidential campaign.
The outcome of the 24 presidential campaign was desolating in the extreme for La Follette. Now, he could derive some consolation from the nearly 5 million votes that he garnered in that, which was a record for a third party or an independent party movement in American history. He won the state of Wisconsin. He got those electoral votes. Most impressively, he finished second. He beat John W. Davis, the Wall Street lawyer who was running as the Democratic candidate in 1924. He beat out Davis in 11 states. That was probably one of the most impressive outcomes. But the fact remains that that Coolidge won an overwhelming victory. Not only that, but both houses of Congress remained in Republican hands. The outcome of the campaign had a very negative impact, a very discouraging impact on the progressives who at their July 1924 convention in Cleveland were hoping that the La Follette campaign of 1924 would be of sufficient sufficient success for a new party to come into existence. That's what they were hoping for. But they were disillusioned by the outcome, and it really, really confirmed that, for better or worse, the United States is stuck with the two-party system. That's the conclusion that Beard reached in a book that he wrote about the American party system, 1928. It's called The American Party Battle. We're stuck with this. And so what we need to do is to promote in the Democratic Party a strong progressive movement that will be prepared to take over the party once the policies of the regnant elements in the Democratic Party once their policies are perceived to be the catastrophes that they surely will be.
Talk about big money in politics in that campaign.
Oh, big money. Well, the Republicans outspent the La Follette campaign by a wide margin. I don't have the exact numbers in my mind right now, but
yeah, I have them in front. Yeah, have them in
why don't
front,
you read them, Alan?
The progressives spent $222,000.
Right.
The Democrats spent $903,000.
Yeah.
And the Republicans, the Coolidge crowd, the Business of America's business crowd, $4,270,000 approximately.
Here's something to add to those official figures. Kenneth Campbell McKay, who's written the most detailed monograph on the Progressive Campaign of 1924. That's the title of his book. But he did research that showed how much more money the Republicans raised beyond the official numbers. I mean, they just had an overwhelming financial advantage. And not only the financial advantage, but the Republicans adopted a strategy. Their mantra was Coolidge or chaos. If you even think about voting for La Follette, you workers for the big companies really conducted a very spirited campaign, very effective campaign to detach working class people from the progressive, this independent progressive movement. So it wasn't just a financial advantage. They had an organizational advantage that was overwhelming. The La Follette campaign just couldn't match the skill, the expertise that the other campaigns, particularly the Republican campaign, could mount. And this is why Kenneth Campbell McKay, in his study of the 24 campaign, says the advantages that the major parties have foredoom these third party movements to defeat, because they just can't match the money, the organizational skill, all the hurdles that these third party independent movements. We're seeing some of that today with candidates like Cornel West. I don't know if you've talked about him on your program, or Jill Stein, trying to negotiate all the signatures that they need to run in these various states, get on the ballots. Each state has its own particular election laws. It's a bewildering, a Byzantine maze that virtually make it impossible for third parties to compete effectively against the big two, the Democrats and the Republicans. And I think the 24 campaign illustrates that point.
So if you had to condense it down, boil it down to the significance of that 24 campaign, what would you tell our listeners?
The significance for me is the prophetic character of it, that both La Follette and Wheeler, both of them were very eloquent, very ardent in promoting the case that the American political and economic system they're not working. They're not working for the common good. They work for the lobbies. Those are the beneficiaries of the system that we have. They were making that argument in 1924. The argument is still good for 2024. We have the same problems. And this is why I think we can learn from the insights that those two leaders presented and apply them to our situation today.
Beginning today, the Progressive Magazine will be commemorating the 100th anniversary of Fighting Bob La Follette's 24 presidential bid with a series of programs featuring a number of notable speakers and artists, among them Richard Drake, who's been with us today. The first panel today at 2 p.m. at the Wisconsin Historical Society on the Library Mall will include Richard Drake, as well as the La Follette biographer Nancy Unger and Cap Times columnist John Nichols. Events are free and open to the public. For a full schedule, you can go to www.progressive.org or call 608-257-4626. Richard Drake, we got a minute or two left. Some parting words for our listeners?
Well, I hope that
let me phrase it differently.
Okay.
What is, drawing from that history, what is your single most concern as we head toward another election year?
My single greatest concern is the threat that the American empire poses to the nation. And no one spoke more eloquently, more passionately, more intelligently than Robert La Follette did in echoing those concerns 100 years ago. And I think his legacy is one of the most precious elements that we have in the history of our politics. I've spent a lot of my life trying to arouse an awareness in readers about how vital his legacy is. And we're going to continue that campaign over the next few days in the conference that Alan has just mentioned. And I hope that as many of you as possible will come out and participate. We'd love to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you ever so much for your time with us today. I want to thank you ever so much for your work in elucidating what you've laid out somewhat here today. And I hope to, I'm looking forward to the William Appleman Williams book, of course.
Okay. All right. So, thank you, Alan.
Ever so much. I want to thank Jack for engineering. I want to thank Jade for producing. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week.
Frequency radio modulation, the big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision flyby helicopters in the night, attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Attention WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2027. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Wednesday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 30th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 30th. More information and board applications are available at WORTFM.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
Supported. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Une fois que t'as senti l'âme, tu t'allonges sur ton dos.
Yeah.
Tu es là. Tu manques de bruit.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
Recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level.
Hello, this is Julie Candler with the BBC News. The US Supreme Court has been hearing arguments on whether Donald Trump is immune from prosecution for actions he took while president. The outcome will determine whether he should face trial on charges that he plotted to overturn his 2020 election defeat, as Gary O'Donoghue explains.
The nine justices heard a case like no other they've considered before. At issue, should a president, in this case Donald Trump, have immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts taken while in office? He's facing four separate charges amounting to a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election. The court is unlikely to deliver a judgment on this case for a couple of months. And while granting total immunity may be unlikely, the delays are making it increasingly probable that the January the 6th trial may not happen before November's election. And were Mr. Trump to win that election, he could simply order his Justice Department to drop it.
The ruling in this case won't affect his criminal trial,